You're listening to Agile Ideas, the podcast, hosted by Fatima Ibuchi.
For anyone listening out there not having a good day, please know there is help out there.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Agile Ideas. I'm Fatima, CEO at Agile Management Office, Mental Health Ambassador, and your host. On today's episode, I have a powerhouse of a woman, Divya Pasupalleti. Divya is a highly accomplished leader in the telecommunications, project management, and not-for-profit industries. She's known for delivering complex business transformations, customer-centric strategies, and commercial results. She serves on the boards and advisory committees of several community-based organizations and not-for-profits. She's passionate about gender equity in the workplace and spearheads several initiatives that aim to make an impact at a systemic level. She's a sought-after mentor for women in STEM, international conference speaker, and a finalist for Gender Equity Award in Australia. Please join me in welcoming Divya to the show. Divya, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Fatima. I'm very pleased to be here.
It's been probably one that I've been keen to have since we met, I think, mid last year at a PMI event. And then we kept talking and talking, and then we met for coffee and kept talking and talking. And I was like, we've got to talk on a podcast / video so that everyone else can share the insights that you share with me that is, you know, quite interesting and diverse for what you've done in your career so far. So I wanted to start with that. I wanted you to tell us in your own words a little bit about your career journey so far, because I think it's fascinating and really keen to share some of that insight with our listeners.
Absolutely. Firstly, let me start again by thanking for having me here on the podcast. I'm a big fan of your podcast and I listen to it quite regularly. So I'm very, very excited to be on it. My journey, so I currently work in the telecommunications industry. I head up strategy and enablement for the business segment. And if I reflect back on my professional journey, it's predominantly been in the telecommunications industry in various shapes and form. I've started in a very technical space, and then I moved to vendor management, partner management, hardcore operations, even managing field workforce. And now I think I'm kind of in that happy space of designing strategy and then leading it through execution and that business transformation space. However, it was not always by plan. Telco really happened by accident. Okay. I studied, and my postgraduate studies and my academic years have been in the field of biotechnology and molecular biology. In fact, studied to be a research scientist. I did research work funded by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the malarial vaccine space. So it was quite a transformational journey if I really look back, and it's been amazing. I am a better professional and a leader now for the journey that I've had. And other than my primary role, I am very passionate about being involved in the community and giving back in whatever shape and form, whether it's in the professional services space or gender representation, cultural representation. And I am on boards and advisory committees with organizations that work in this space. And I am, that I think is very closely aligned to my values and something that I've been doing for as long as I can remember. As a kid, even I remember being involved with UNICEF, for example. So this is something that's been part of me and my journey. At home, I live with my husband and my mom, and in a very supportive environment where they fuel everything that I do and enable all my craziness. So I guess that's me.
It's really interesting career path for where you sort of started in the research space in the malaria sort of space, and then moving into telecommunications, being in project management. How do you find the work that you did in your research years contribute to what you're doing in project management? Like, obviously you're in strategy, so there's a little bit of that in there, but how is the two related, if at all?
Interesting question. I've been in this project program management space, transformation space, for many years now, and one of the constant feedbacks I get from my clients and key stakeholders is my strength in execution and delivery, and how I'm able to come up with unique solutions and innovative solutions, being able to think outside the box. I reflected on it and I'm like, why am I doing this? And then I realized, because my background is not very traditional in the telco industry or the project management industry, I apply a very research-led mindset and a very experimental mindset to my ways of doing things. Whenever I'm posed with a problem, I'm thinking about, you know, what are the different ways we can experiment with the solution? I'm thinking about, you know, have we found innovative ways to resolve this, or are we going the traditional way? I think that played a key role, and it's all my early years of really honing that research mindset that helped. But also, I think one of the key attributes which I always am very grateful for in terms of my success has been my adoption and understanding and my relationship with failure, really. When I was doing my research work, I can't remember, I must have done thousands of experiments day in, day out, and 99% of them fail. And initially, I was very disappointed. I took it personally. I'm like, why am I doing something wrong? Why are my experiments not failing? But very soon you realize it's not you. It's you know, you found so many ways or thousands of ways of it not working to find that one way of making it work. And I think I apply that in my day-to-day, in my personal professional life now, where if I fail, it's not about me. I examine it, I dissect it, and I look at what failed, what parameter can I change and make it work the next time. So I think that really experimental relationship with failure has been a big, big mindset shift for me, and I attribute it to my research years.
That's really good, because I think that a lot of the time we find that organizations develop out these amazing strategies that are hundreds of pages long, and they sell, you know, the big execs on it, and they get the funding for it, but then it actually falls over when it comes to execution. So you talked about being involved in strategy to execution, which we know some leaders are predominantly on the strategy side and they leave execution to, you know, other teams and areas. How are you, in your roles that you've been working in, organizations you've been working in, bridging the gap between the two to make sure that there's alignment between strategy and execution?
I'm a strong believer, and I know there are people who are in different camps when it comes to the word strategy. Mm-hmm. And strategy can mean different things to different people. For me, it's simply having a very clear vision and a very clear understanding of the why you want to get there, and then enabling your teams to adopt and be part of that vision, have very clear roles and accountabilities and a line of sight as to why we're doing. And the main focus for me is always execution. I'm a project professional through and through, and I focus my efforts on the delivery, but with a very clear understanding of where we are going, what the end game is. So if you ask me, I feel like I index more on the delivery, but with a very clear understanding of why we are doing this and where we are headed to. And when these two are integrated quite well together, I find that it's you find initiatives, outcomes, programs very successful, because they're not two separate things. It's not strategy and then delivery. It is you're delivering with a strategic outcome in mind. So they're kind of very interrelated. I can't find a way to distinguish both of them. And I know organizations have departments and teams, yes, who do separate things. And that's probably where the failure is, because they're so siloed and act as separate organizations, whereas they're one and the same. So big supporter of bringing it together.
I can't agree more. I've seen that example that you just described, where strategy team puts all the effort in developing out the strategy, getting the sign-offs to the business case, and then they hand it over to delivery teams, and then it doesn't ever deliver on what the strategy said. Whereas if you integrate the two teams together, which is something we strongly advocate at AMO as well, it means that you're going to get a better outcome. So I love that. I think that's great. And I think go one step further and bring in the operational lens as well. I don't think that we can discount that at all, because at the end of the day, they're the ones that are going to own the solution. So,
and the customer. And I think one of the biggest groups that we forget through this whole chain is who is using this, who are we building for, who's going to be benefiting from all this. And I think that insight and that co-designing throughout is something that people really forget. We build all these amazing things and hope people will come to it, but sometimes it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, 100%. We can even take some of that lesson for small businesses like ours, which, you know, we don't get the the big consultancies coming in and helping us, but as a small business, you find that they do actually have to do strategy and execution at the same time. So we can definitely learn from that. I wanna go back to you mentioned doing work with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. How did that come about? Like, how did you get that opportunity, and what was that like?
I was very fortunate to land a research project with a lab that was funded by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And I wanted, when I was pursuing my postgraduate studies and my research work, I was very, I was very firm or very clear that I wanted to work on something that had a real-time impact. And I come from India, and I know that, you know, diseases like malaria are quite prevalent. And I think I connected with the cause and the purpose and what they were supporting. It was amazing. I loved that whole period of my research work. In fact, my thesis has been published, and it's now stored in the National Library of Australia and often used as a reference. So it was a unique way of finding the solution. So not going into too much technical detail, but trying to use a newly found shark antibody that can help be part of the solution as part of a vaccine for malaria. And the lab was focused on the research. So I enjoyed my time and enjoyed the brains that sat behind it and the brainstorming and finding unique solutions. It was amazing. It was a great learning experience. I wouldn't change it at all.
No, definitely not. Sounds like something that would have been a once in a lifetime opportunity. That's great. And it's also really great that you get to leverage the academic background into your project management role, which we know sometimes the two don't meet, but it's really good that you've got the both of them coming together. When you think about your career so far, what are some of the biggest obstacles that you've overcome? You've told me a lot about some of the positives, but have you had any challenging moments or obstacles that you've had to face, and what was that like to overcome them?
Oh, heaps. I can go on and on about the obstacles that I faced, and if I reflect on the obstacles and group them into categories, I think one of the biggest categories would be being undermined for my age or gender or my cultural background. I learned very quickly that people have a lot of assumptions and biases, and people prefer to have a person promoted into a senior role based on their age, because the assumption was that they had more experience, and hence it translated to better skills or even the vision of a leader and what a leader looks like. You know, typically when you think about a leader, or when I say generally, when people think about leader, they think about a man who is very assertive, very charismatic, and which is not the definition of what I portray, a woman who is, from a culturally diverse background with an accent. I probably don't meet that criteria, and hence I found that it really hindered my opportunities at times. It also meant that I had to often spend double the time trying to convince people that I'm capable of, which they believed after actually seeing my outcomes and consistent delivery. And I really wish I didn't have to go through those loops of, you know, trying to demonstrate and convince people that I'm capable. Now that I have a reasonable platform and wise, I am very committed to creating more awareness, and I think really redefining, if there is one life goal of mine, is redefining what success or a leader looks like, or a good leader looks like, and really introducing the realistic concepts of, you know, it being, you know, someone who is a female perhaps, or someone from a totally culturally diverse background, has a heavy accent, but brings such amazing lived experience and insights to the table. That's been one of my biggest obstacles in general.
I think that's part of the reason why when we connected at that PMI event as well, your story resonated, you know, being from a cult background as well. I think you're spot on. The age factor comes into it. There's the judgment that comes with it. I think it's evolved more recently than maybe 20 years ago, at least for what I saw when I was sort of coming up. But it just felt like it didn't matter how hard you worked. And sometimes we have to work twice or three times as hard because we're women, or because we're young, or because we're culturally diverse backgrounds, to just meet, you know, at that level. And I find the same thing in business, running business as well. It's like competing with you know, with men typically, like you described as well. So I think a lot of people who are listening would probably resonate with that message. And it's great that you're doing a lot of work in that sort of gender space. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about that we haven't spoken much about on this podcast is inclusive leadership. And what does inclusive leadership mean to you?
Really boiled down, inclusive leadership for me is treating others in a fair and equitable way. And that often means, and which probably doesn't resonate a lot with people, often means that really, really self-reflecting and trying to understand our own biases, both conscious and unconscious. Just reflecting on your earlier point of, you know, being undermined for whether it's age, cultural background, etc. Some of the arguments that I've come across are, oh, but we don't see age or gender. We recruit based on merit. And I'm like, that's amazing you do that. Can you define merit for me, please? Mm-hmm. And then they go on to, you know, merit because this person speaks really well in public settings without understanding that there are groups of people who probably have not been enabled to do that quite effectively, or because culturally speaking up in public forums is considered, you know, being rude. Or for me personally, I found challenging senior leaders as something that I can't do in a public setting because it was in my upbringing, it's considered very rude and impolite to do that. Mm-hmm. So I think when people talk about recruiting on merit, it really gets me because the definition of merit and what they envision as merit is really, really dated, if I may put it that way. But anyways, coming back to inclusive leadership is really trying to, I guess, challenge our own biases and ensuring that what we do, how we treat people is fair and equitable for others.
Why do you think that, you know, I know certainly for me, and I'm sure others listening, that we probably get, they just deal with it, you know, figure it out, navigate it, you know, get over it. That sort of commentary is probably what I heard anyway. Why do you think that it's important, but also not enough to just learn how to deal with it?
It's funny because that's exactly what I heard through my early years in my career. And generally the advice I've always been given is, oh, grow a thicker skin. And one of my real mentors who I respect a lot and with good intention, he once told me when I faced a situation of harassment, he said, oh, but you're going to face a lot more of this. If you want to grow through the ranks and be a leader in this space, you have to learn to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And as much as it's important because it really helped me persevere at that point in time and grow my resilience muscle. And I probably wouldn't have gone through the journey without that advice at that point in time. I find it, you know, I find that we are way past the point now, Fatima. It's that kind of advice is no longer relevant nor accepted by at least the newer generations. And people are learning to challenge this kind of advice. You know, you have to do the hard yard in, you have to put in the years to get to where you want. I think people are starting to challenge that, and it's no longer relevant in this day and age. But yeah, it was important at that time because I think it helped a lot of us, like me, to get through that situation.
Yeah, and like you said, it's common advice that, you know, we usually get, and I heard the same thing growing up. One of the things that I found the most useful for me over the years, I've gotten better at, I feel like is helpful for others that have, you know, have gone through or are going through the situations we've described, is I think learning how to manage our emotions. So it's not hiding our emotions or ignoring our emotions, but learning how to manage them that will help us to react differently in the way that we need to in certain situations. Because, you know, sometimes it's just quite difficult, quite a challenge when you're constantly being told just to deal with something and people aren't understanding it from your perspective. So I think, yeah, it's a really good moment to think about remembering to manage our emotions as well.
100%, and I think that's the key, right? Whilst you want to be all geared up to tackle a situation like that head on and say things, at the same time, it's very important we know the system we operate in and the society we operate in, and being able to very strategically have that conversation is very important. And which means that, you know, understanding our emotions, managing the emotions, play a very big role in that.
And thinking about gender balance, gender equity, what are sort of like maybe one or two suggestions that either you have for other large corporates that you maybe when you start in there those organizations you look for or you recommend or that you can recommend to listeners that if they want to do better in that space? Because I agree the merit thing it doesn't necessarily make sense, and I've seen on the other side of it where I've been told make sure that when you are screening interview candidates make sure you include two women. We have to interview two women. It's like a benchmark that we have to, even if they have absolutely no interest in those candidates at all. Just such a waste of time for them. So it's sad for me that I've seen and heard that. But is there some suggestions or recommendations you commonly make?
To your point, the first one would be exactly that. Please don't do tick box exercises of trying to achieve diversity. I think if you are listening to this and you are one of those people who was having two candidates in the shortlist just because you're picking ensuring that there's diversity in the candidate pool, please don't do it. I would encourage you to dig deeper and try to understand why is diversity important? What role can diversity play in your organization, in your teams? Because and there's ample evidence out there to prove why diversity is important, not only for innovation but also for better mental well-being for teams. Because if you are working with people exactly like you, you're not really challenging each other, you're not innovating, you're not progressing, and there's enough evidence to suggest business results, great business results as well as a result of diversity. But yes, first one would be please dig deeper, please challenge yourselves, especially if it's a leader who is committed to doing better by their teams and organizations. I would highly recommend investing and spending time understanding what inclusive leadership is, especially and taking the time to meeting new people who are not like them. I ask this question to a lot of my mentees or even friends, for that example. Who do you go to advice for? If your inner circle or if your circle of trust looks and feels exactly like you, so it's people like you from the same background, same age group, and same professional background, for example, you can do better. Diversify your inner circle and you would be such a better leader for it, and trust me with that.
It's a good segue into talking about mentor because I know you do a lot of mentoring and you've been doing that through the PMI Melbourne chapter, I think through some universities and through some of your corporate roles. How do you determine if someone's the right fit for you to be mentoring them? I mean, is there sort of something you look for in that person? Is it the way they request it? I don't want to open floodgates of people requesting you to be mentoring them, but what do you look for in a mentee?
Firstly, if someone reaches out, I will give them the time and day because I think it's my way of, I've reached out to so many people through my journey, and I always respected the people who at least gave me one conversation, one chat, and I'm committed to doing that as much as my time and space can allow, but I haven't said no so far. But what makes a good mentee, or what I look for in a mentee, is someone who has put in the time to understand exactly what they want out of that relationship. Are they looking for general advice? Is it operational guidance that they're looking for? When I say operational, tactical guidance in their current roles. Are they looking to develop themselves in a specific area, and are they clear about why that's important for them? Or is it a strategic aspiration of them, and hence that's why they're reaching out, because they want to change their industries completely, and they're looking for looking to understand. So I would look to see how much self-reflection a person has put in. And again, no pressure, but I think even if it's at very early stages of this, understanding is enough for me, because I'm not one of those mentors who looks for a very structured way of having every single conversation. So I'm very okay for it to be a organic chat, but at the same time, be clear, because we are investing time. I, as a mentor, always invest my energy into it, to ensuring that the person's getting something out of it. So a good vision and an understanding of that purpose would be something that I look for or try to get out of that initial conversation.
It's a really good call, and I think it's important that mentees who want to request time from people like us is to actually just make sure that you are aware, you know, look into your background, look at your journey, whether it's on LinkedIn, if you've been following you for a while, so that you can articulate what it is that you need, because it helps us to save time that we know is very limited. But also it might be that we're talking to someone and realize, you know what, the person that's reached out to me may actually be better off talking to yourself, for example, because I might not be the best place to support them in that journey. And also, I think one of the things I'm sure you've probably experienced this yourself, you've probably had different mentors at different points in your career. They're not always the same mentor the whole way through. Would that be fair to say?
100%, 100%. My needs from my mentors have changed over the years. And what I look for at one point in time is not the same anymore. And I'm sure it will evolve. And I'm probably sharing a lot of information here, but I don't have one mentor. I have many mentors. I would give that as a hot tip as well.
Yes.
It's just like a relationship, you know. You can't expect to get you can't expect to meet every emotional need of yours from one relationship. Similarly with mentors, you can't expect to get everything from one person. And I think you really have to diversify your mentoring relationships as well.
100%. 100%. I've had I can't even count how many, and I've got one that started mentoring me through the business journey that I've been on for like the last 10 years. Now we started meeting monthly, but now I probably see him once or twice a year because the relationship that we have together is very different, and what he is providing for me in that space is different than what I needed 5 years ago. So don't be afraid to have lots of mentors, and if you know, some people have stronger capabilities in a certain area, that's the what you need in this point in time. So I think that's really good, and it also spreads the load across multiple people as well, so we can help more people.
Agree.
I wanted to just quickly come back to your industry experience. So you've obviously spent a long time in telco as one of the areas and not-for-profits, etc. Just in thinking about that sort of telco space, we've done a bit of work within the utility space last year, and I've seen that industry is evolving a lot. What do you think the sort of most changes that have happened in that space in terms of projects and portfolio management and transformation and strategy? Is there any specific examples you can give around how that industry is evolving? Because it is obviously is such a significant industry.
True. And timing couldn't have been more perfect to have this conversation, because we are just, I probably wouldn't say we're coming out of the COVID, but we've experienced a good period of the pandemic and working from home, or, you know, lockdowns, and internet in general has never been so important in people's life to stay connected, to conduct business, to do work, whatever it might look like, just to live day-to-day lives. I think internet in general, but you know, telecommunications industry as an enabler have never been more important. In fact, people are starting to see that as a utility now than anything else. And I think that has been one of the biggest shifts in the industry in terms of the way people perceive what telco means to them. And at the same time, then comes the emphasis on, you know, then is your internet provider, you know, meeting your requirements? And one of the biggest shifts I've seen is not only in terms of the demand of demand from a consumption perspective, but also what telco and internet especially means for customers, whether they're residential customers or biggest customers. I think that has been the biggest focus areas, or is the biggest focus areas for a lot of telcos, is how do they understand their customers' evolving needs, which has increased significantly, exponentially, even over the past few years, and how do they cater to their needs and requirements, not only now, but also into the future. And I think that's one of the biggest opportunities, but also comes with it, you know, challenges, and there are multiple challenges. I'll probably focus on the challenge that I'm more passionate about, is trying to attract the right kind of talent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the good news is that it's not as you don't need to have the technical experience, and you can use my own experience in that regards. You don't need to have a lot of technical know-how to enter into industries such as technology or telecommunications industries, but really a good understanding of customers, customer behaviors, and human motivations in general is enough for you to be able to pursue a career in the telco industry. And one of the challenges that most organizations, especially technology and telco, have now is trying to find that right talent, and the pool in the market is so scarce now with the labor shortages that we have, that it's going to encourage organizations to think beyond the obvious. I guess right time to diversify your talent pool.
Yeah, and I think you just described one of the ways of doing that. Rather than assuming that everybody needs to have said industry experience, be open to bringing people that have experience from different industries but that are completely relatable and transferable skills, which is something that I think more hiring managers need to be considering.
That would be, I think, one of the biggest levers organizations can use, is challenging what they define. Again, going back to the definition of success, merit, what does success look like for a role when you're recruiting? Mm-hmm. Mandatory 15 years of technology experience, you probably don't need that. If you're leading people, you need more people skills. You need that adaptive leadership experience than anything else.
Yeah, 100%. It's interesting. I one of the things when I look back at my career, one of the things I get asked a lot is like, how have you done so many different industries? I think I'm about 16, 17 industries. My goal was to get into as many industries as possible so I could figure out which one I like best. Or, you know, I don't have a favorite, I have multiple favorites, but I wouldn't have known that if I didn't have those opportunities. But I remember some, you know, years ago being interviewed and being told, well, you don't have mining experience, how are you supposed to go into mining? Or not having banking experience or not having retail experience. But as I've sort of proven, and others have as well, you don't need to have that industry experience. Maybe in some roles there might be an absolute necessity, but if you're talented at what you do and you're willing to put in the work, you can learn that stuff, but you need to come in proactive and obviously be willing to learn. So I think that's a really good advice, and recruiters should definitely take that on board.
100%. And I think it also needs, and I think we put a lot of onus on the recruitment space of organizations in general, but it's a business problem. And I think businesses, executives need to be super aware of this. And again, you know, people go into the tick box exercise of, oh, is your organization diverse? But really trying to go down to the next layers would be very helpful.
100%. And I mean, if I use a real recent example, some of our best employees have been interns that have had no experience except they've come from academia. And, you know, they've stayed on many years with us and have done a brilliant job learning across different industries. So it's very possible. You just have to be a bit open-minded, I think, because speaking of teams, sort of round out, I wanted to talk to you about sort of fostering high performance teams, and particularly in the context of business transformation. So, you know, could you talk us through some of the strategies that you employ to foster high performance teams?
I've learned a lot through my mistakes over the years, and I think, going back to my research years, I've fine-tuned the art of observation. So I observe people very closely, successful leaders, successful teams. And what I've found is often teams and individuals fail when they get very competitive, and in two main areas I think this falls under. First one is people get very competitive, they want to be responsible for delivering something, and in pursuit of that they often work in silos and lose the touch of collaboration, and really underestimate the value of collaboration, and not just collaboration in general but diverse collaboration, so thinking beyond the obvious. In learning from that, I ensure now that in my teams that I foster a culture of collaboration. And I keep saying, not the obvious, go beyond the obvious. If you feel like if you're going through an operating model or remodeling of organization, you typically involve operational leaders, you involve HR, for example. But think about maybe someone from a technical background should be part of those conversations, because I did that and I have gained enormously through those conversations and ideas. So I think that's one thing to really foster a collaborative environment. I would always advocate for the power of being super crystal clear on the vision, both individually for the roles and as a team. And the definition of goals, and that real good line of sight of where we are now, where are we getting to, and how are we going to get there, and keeping that alignment in place through the process. And this can be achieved through good planning conversations, good team sessions where you are discussing, you know, why are we doing this? Keep challenging. I keep challenging myself and my team to think about, why are we doing this? What is the value add? You know, is it in line with our goals? And those conversations help people be very focused and clear on where we are getting to. And I found that a very good enabler of team success. And I think at the end of the day, having fun is very important because we spend a good amount of time at work, and being having a work environment that's psychologically safe and is fun and collaborative beats any big 60-page pack of strategy and innovative white papers or whatever. I think these are basics are always the important ones.
And you said it well. You have to think about what you can learn from those other people. I've seen some people engage, you know, John and Mary Smith from a different area and realize, actually, we've already done a project like that. This is the value points and here's all the data from that. Whereas if we're working in those silos, we're reinventing the wheel over and over and over again, which is completely a waste of time. So I love that. I think that's great. I'm keen to just sort of round out. We're obviously in 2024 now, and I like to always stress about the importance of accountability. So I'm going to put you on the spot here and ask you, what's on the horizon for you? Is there any goals or anything exciting that you wanted to share for 2024 that you haven't told us about that you want to splurge now and let us know, or anything you're looking forward to?
Oh, heaps for him. I'm very excited for 2024. And I always start a year with a clear plan of what I want and in various aspects of my life, whether it's career, personal, health, etc. But some of the things that I'm really excited for and looking forward to this year are, as you may or may not know, I am the sponsor for Women in Project Management Initiative as part of PMI in Victoria. And we have some amazing things coming out of that space to support women, whether it's entering into the project management space or, enhancing their careers in project management. And I'm very excited for that. I have recently been elected elected to the Regional Advisory Council for Victorian Multicultural Commission. And I'm on this journey of trying to understand my own cultural intersectionality and how I can enable communities within Victoria to do that. And I'm really looking forward to what I can do and contribute from that role and the remits of that role. So I'm very excited for that. And every year I commit to my own learning and development. And this year I am pursuing a leadership program called Williamson's Community Leadership Program that's led by Leadership Victoria. And it's a very well-known program in terms of people undergoing transformative leadership mindset journeys. And I want to ensure that this program gives me that space to reflect on my own leadership style and how I can be a better leader. So I'm very much looking forward to that.
Amazing. That sounds good. On top of all the work that you do with other areas like the PMI Melbourne chapter and other boards, etc. So now you've said it live on this podcast. It's official, so that I'm going to check in with you in 12 months and make sure it's all happened though. It sounds amazing. Well done and congratulations for those appointments. We're almost at the end of our time here today. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners, a call to action, a piece of advice, or a question to ponder before we wrap up today?
Well, it would be a missed opportunity if I didn't challenge your listeners to think deeper and reflect on their own biases. So I think I'll probably leave everyone with this is, you know, spend some time thinking about your own, obvious and unconscious biases that you may hold, and think about, you know, who are you spending time with? Can that group be more diverse? Who are you recruiting? Can you recruit someone that doesn't seem like the right fit on the surface, but might bring a lot more value to your teams? And it's really, you know, really reflect on your own behaviors and if they're aligned with being an inclusive leader. There's so much material out there on the web that people can look up and learn about what inclusive leadership is and what behaviors that they can really, really work on to demonstrate being an inclusive leader. So I would leave everyone with that.
Amazing. Great advice. Thank you, Divya, for being part of the show. We really appreciate it. And I'm sure that anyone wants to reach out to you, we'll put your contact details in the show notes. But otherwise, have a very happy and safe 2024. And I'm sure I'll talk to you again very soon.
Thanks so much, Fatima. I really enjoyed this conversation and I'm looking forward to the next year.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. please share this with someone or rate it if you enjoyed it. Don't forget to follow us on social media, and to stay up to date with all things Agile Ideas, go to our website www.agilemanagementoffice.com. I hope you've been able to learn, feel, or be inspired today. Until next time, what's your Agile Idea?